It is nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 44 degrees under mostly cloudy skies. Hosts jumped up to 46 degrees. At the airport, they indicate they have west winds to 16 miles per hour, gusting to 23, and 10 miles of visibility. The Weather Service continues to call for mostly cloudy skies for the rest of the day and tonight too, and mostly sunny skies tomorrow. Look for west winds gusting as high as 20 today, becoming completely calm overnight tonight, coming back up to 5 or 10 tomorrow, and then finally turning to the south in the afternoon. Coming up on the Midday Report, the Alaska legislature fails to override Governor Dunleavy's veto of the elections reform bill.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is running the White House briefing this hour. Reporters are peppering him with questions about the U.S. and Iran's dueling blockades in the Strait of Hormuz. Rubio defends the administration's attempt to guide commercial ships through the strategically important global oil shipping route.
This is not an offensive operation. This is a defensive operation. And what that means is very simple. There's no shooting unless we're shot at first. Okay, we're not attacking them. But if they're attacking us or they're attacking a ship, you need to respond to that. You're not going to let some fast boat come up on the ship and shoot it up.
Rubio is the first to fill in for White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt, who's on maternity leave. He engaged with reporters from a broad range of news organizations and at times joked with the media over his attempt to stick to White House briefing protocol. Rubio also repeatedly credited President Trump on foreign policy matters. Rubio is one of the key members of this administration, widely viewed as a likely contender for the 2028 Republican presidential nomination. Vice President J.D. Vance is another. Vance was voting today in Ohio's Republican primary for governor. He's also scheduled to visit Iowa. In the fallout of the war and rising fuel prices, air travel is getting more expensive. NPR's Stephen Bazaha has that story.
An international flight, on average, cost about $150 more than it did a year ago. Some flights and destinations are up a lot more, like a ticket to London going up about $350. This is also causing some in the United States to change their travel plans. Lee Collins was flying back to Atlanta after visiting family in D.C. and said he is not planning a summer vacation trip.
As of now, no, not really. Because like I said, air travel is very expensive. So it's going to be a staycation this year.
Airfare hikes are due to the price of jet fuel nearly doubling since the start of the year due to the war against Iran and its proxies. Stephen Bazaha, NPR News.
Civil rights organizations have filed a new class action lawsuit to pause a 2023 Texas immigration enforcement law from taking effect next week. Texas Public Radio's Maria Navarro reports.
What's known as Senate Bill 4 makes entering Texas illegally from another country a state-level crime. It then allows local and state law enforcement to arrest, detain, and remove individuals suspected of doing so. The law is set to go into effect May 15th after surviving previous challenges in court. The Texas Civil Rights Project, the American Civil Liberties Union, and other groups argue SB 4 is unconstitutional since immigration enforcement is solely under the jurisdiction of the federal government. They also say the law will lead to the separation of families, racial profiling, and turn police and judges into immigration agents. I'm Maria Navarro in San Antonio.
From Washington, this is NPR News.
NPR News is brought to you in part by Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. For an appointment or more information, 481-2400.
For KMXT News, I'm Terry Haynes. The Alaska legislature failed to override Governor Mike Dunleavy's veto of a closely watched election reform bill yesterday afternoon. The override vote failed by two votes after two Southeast Alaska lawmakers who had previously supported the bill voted no. As Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports, backers said they hoped the bill would make it easier to vote and harder to cheat.
Sometimes in the Alaska legislature, just as in life, timing is everything. Timing is what Governor Dunleavy cited in his message to lawmakers announcing his veto. With the November election just 6 months away, he says there just isn't time to implement a system allowing voters to track and correct minor errors on their absentee ballots. The lawmakers who flipped, Sitka Senator Bert Stedman and Ketchikan Representative Jeremy Bynum, both Republicans, say they agree with Dunleavy's assessment. Here's Bynum.
From the time that the bill was passed to the time that the governor actually got it, there was delay. And then when the governor got it, there was delay.
But Senator Bill Willikowski, an Anchorage Democrat, says there was plenty of time to implement the bill. He pointed to the all-male special primary election following the death of Congressman Don Young in 2022.
Just 5-6 weeks later, the governor's Division of Elections announced that ballot tracking would be available by the company Ballot Tracks for the June 11, 2022 election. 6 weeks. They got a ballot tracking system set up in 6 weeks. Just 4 years ago.
One caveat on that, it's the lieutenant governor, not the governor, who heads the Division of Elections. And 4 years later, there's a different lieutenant governor and a different director of the Division of Elections. That new Division of Elections director, though, said in March that implementing a tracking system would be, quote, challenging. Not notably that it couldn't be done. And Willikowski says he wishes the administration was up for the challenge.
I'm not prepared to tell Alaskans, sorry, you'll have to wait another year. It's just too hard.
Willikowski and co-sponsor Representative Sarah Vance, a conservative Homer Republican, say they tried to strike a bipartisan balance.
Right now, our system is broken where not every vote is being counted. Our roles have not been tightened up to the level that builds confidence, that ensures people that they have a legal vote.
The bill included prepaid postage on absentee ballots, an elections liaison for rural communities, and better pay for election workers in villages where it's often difficult to find people to staff the polls. And there was a requirement that voters be notified of a data breach, a quicker timeline for reporting results, and provisions aimed at keeping the state's voter rolls correct despite Alaska's transient population. Supporters ranged from the most liberal Democrats to the most conservative Republicans. Big Lake Republican Representative Kevin McCabe, who voted to override the governor, offered an apology.
Not for my vote. I stand by my vote on this bill. I'm apologizing to Alaskans who will bear the cost of this veto.
He apologized to members of the military, people living in rural Alaska, and people in Southwest Alaska who were sent the wrong ballots for the 2024 election, among others. Strikingly, neither advocates nor opponents in the legislature claimed the bill would help one party more than another. Timing was the issue. Dunleavy encouraged lawmakers to try again with another bill. Bynum, who flipped from yes to no, said he would vote for a future bill without such a tight timeline. But with just 2.5 weeks to go in the legislative session, that appears unlikely. There just isn't time. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
We've all heard the statistics: intensifying storms, a warming ocean, warming air temperatures, rapid glacier loss. The climate's getting warmer. But an ongoing tribal project in the Chilkat Valley has something new to offer: data and projections about how climate change will manifest at a hyper-local level. That information will inform a climate adaptation plan. Avery Elfelt with the Alaska Desk sat in on the tribe's latest update and has this story.
Jake Bell works for the Chilkoot Indian Association. He says the tribe has a lot of climate-related projects, but that this one is unique.
Pretty cool. It's like, if you ever had a question of what does that mean here, this is the data as far down, drilled down as it gets. So,
Bell is part of a small team working on a new effort to write a climate adaptation plan for the tribe. A key element is gathering data and projections to better understand the implications of the global phenomenon and Haines specifically, and respond accordingly. Bell says an interesting theme that emerged during community workshops last week was the importance of reevaluating
what tribal stewardship looks like, these resources, and what the cultural traditions teach about valuing a resource, respecting a resource, and treating it well.
Trevor Evan, a consultant with Adaptation International, ran Bell and others through some of his findings. He says that as the Chilkat Valley's younger generations age, they will experience a multitude of shifts as the climate warms.
That means they'll see different plants in different areas. They'll see rivers acting and changing in different ways. They'll see the freshwater boundary maybe changing as the river moves into the bay.
That's some pretty life-changing stuff.
Things like this will be a big part of what it means to grow up here, is watching this change and figuring out ways to live and thrive even amidst it.
The Chilkoot Indian Association hired the climate resilience consulting firm that Evan works for its expertise. A 2024 grant from the Bureau of Indian Affairs is covering the cost. The goal is to identify and respond to potential climate impacts on traditional life and infrastructure in the area. Meredith Pocart, who works in the Tlingit Tribe's Environmental Department, says they held community meetings last fall, which helped identify four main focus areas.
And those are Sauk, Hooligan, Ghat, Sockeye, berries, and extreme weather events.
She adds,
this time, this workshop, we are again kind of going over those four different areas with the community and also working on developing adaptation strategies.
One of the first phases of the project entailed gathering information about how climate change is already manifesting in the local area and what could come in the future. Evan projects that average air temperatures will increase by more than 4 degrees Fahrenheit by mid-century and 8 degrees by late century. He also says marine heat waves and atmospheric rivers will intensify, which can lead to landslides. Evan says earlier snowmelt, more rain, and longer growing seasons, meanwhile, mean mismatches between species and their environment are becoming more likely.
This means that species we normally only see in the transitional forests are moving up into the glaciated areas where there's soils to do so. But it'll definitely mean that the glaciated areas will be retreating. Yeah.
He says that future isn't necessarily locked in place.
But this is our best guess now.
Beyond gathering that data, the end goal is to come up with an action plan with strategies for how the tribe will respond to looming climate impacts. That should happen by this fall. Cindy Price Hagwood participated in this week's workshop and community conversation. She says it was
really interesting to me to see what could happen in our valley, what has happened in our valley, and what, and like I had asked him tonight, what in my lifetime, what changes have happened.
Price Hagwood works for the Chilkoot Indian Association and its traditional food program. She says she's most concerned about how rising temperatures will affect the foods she's enjoyed since childhood.
Growing up with it, it was really wonderful. You know, I have a lot of really good memories of picking berries in this valley and going fishing with my dad and my family and living the subsistence life.
She says she hopes the tribe can keep those traditions going far into the future. Reporting in Haines, I'm Avery Alfelt.
The Norton Sound community of Shaktulik said their goodbyes to Kelly Hunt at a memorial service this Saturday. She was the 19-year-old whose remains were found in a ravine in Spinard 2 weeks ago following her disappearance in January. Friends and family gathered in the school gym for a simple but emotional service, with arms held open and voices raised in song. To bring Kelly Hunt home were finally answered, though not in the way the community had hoped. She was last seen visiting friends in Anchorage on her way to attend the Alaska Christian College in Soldotna. During the service, the lingering question of what happened to Hunt was set aside to grieve and remember her as a young person, full of life and potential, qualities that Linda Bukolik says she cherishes. In her more than two decades as a teacher in Shaktulik, she remembers Hunt as one of the community's most promising students.
She was always positive and willing to jump in and help no matter where. She was very diligent in school. She never gave up. She played sports, of course, basketball and volleyball. And when she was younger, she did wrestling. She always had a smile on her face.
Bukolik says everyone at the school encouraged Hunt to go to college. The community even raised money to help her with expenses because they were proud of how she had overcome so many challenges at an early age.
Her mom died several years ago in Nome, and then her dad died just a couple years ago, and she also lost both of her grandparents within about a year and a half, 2 years.
Bukolik says Hunt was raised by her brothers and was happy to cook and clean for them.
Because she had all brothers, she was the light of their lives, of everybody's life in that family.
Bukolik says Hunt's dog was the love of her life. She would often catch glimpses of them walking near the shore. There was a picture of Hunt giving her dog a big hug in the slideshow that closed the memorial service, along with photos of her high school graduation, dribbling down the court, having fun with friends and loved ones, all set to the tune of I'll Fly Away. Anchorage police continue to investigate her case, and no word yet on how she died. No suspects have been arrested. The restaurant industry is famously tough and expensive to get into. A decade ago, one Anchorage chef decided to minimize risk and start out with a food truck. Now, the owners of the beloved El Green Go's taco truck have finally opened a sit-down restaurant. But as Alaska Public Media's Hannah Floor reports, economically, it couldn't have come at a worse time.
Probably going to be the street taco with pork in it.
Crystal and Tyler Howie are trying to decide what they'll eat the day their restaurant opens.
Am I getting the huevos rancheros, the nachos?
They've been serving and eating the same things for 10 years.
I always get my extra guacamole in there.
But their enthusiasm is still strong.
Black bean coconut queso is like so good, and then you get the nacho sauce, and it's just like...
Tyler Howie didn't plan to open a food truck. It just came down to financing. He couldn't get a loan to start a restaurant, despite years in the industry and a thorough business plan. So when he got the chance to buy a gutted trailer, he jumped. At that point, Crystal was his brand new girlfriend.
Tyler was like, hey, I have this food truck. The first festival is coming up. Like, do you mind helping me out? I'm like, yeah, I guess you're cute. I can help you out.
What she didn't know was she was signing up for an all-nighter that involved wrestling a 150-pound pig carcass in a windstorm.
That first event was a test to our relationship. We'd only been together for about 3 months at that point.
That is true.
For the last decade, the pair have served what Crystal calls really fun tacos and burritos from the El Gringo's food truck in downtown Anchorage. Now they're opening a second restaurant, a sit-down version. But they say starting off with a food truck was key. It's lower risk, Tyler says, and helped them figure out their concept. It also built a following of loyal customers. But it's a tough time to start a restaurant or make the move to a brick and mortar. The global economy is shaky. Food prices are unstable. Tariffs are unpredictable. Julie O'Malley says it's always a gamble to start a restaurant. O'Malley has been writing about the food scene in Anchorage for over a decade.
Making this step, even though you know you have a market and you know you have a good product, is a risk, especially in this very unprecedented, unstable economic moment in the United States.
She says restaurants never make a ton of money. Margins are tight, and it's even harder to have a restaurant in Alaska, where customers are limited. The labor pool is limited. Getting ingredients can be complicated and expensive. The whole operation is risky, so El Gringo's move makes a lot of sense.
Having a food truck makes you a little bit more nimble, especially if you're trying to kind of like edge your way into the business.
Tyler says starting out with a food truck was the right way to go, but it wasn't easy.
20 years of experience in a restaurant didn't help as much in a food truck because it was so different with the storage and not having an office to get all the paperwork done. So again, you got to go home and get everything done. And we were closed on Sundays. That was invoice day.
That lack of storage meant daily Costco trips, hours spent shopping for ingredients after a full day of work. Now they have so much storage. Their walk-in cooler is the size of their entire food truck. Tyler says they've been thinking about opening a restaurant for years, but they never found just the right spot. He says their new place makes sense. It's not too big, and it was already partly built out.
This business is profit on pennies, not profit on dollars. So if you're losing the pennies, you're not going to make it.
While the U.S. isn't technically in a recession, experts say pockets of the economy are. And overall, there's a real risk of a downturn. Tyler and Crystal Howie say the shaky economy is definitely affecting Anchorage. From talking with friends in the food industry, Tyler says it seems to be the same all over the city. Restaurant sales are down 30-40%. They admit it's not the best time to open a restaurant, but Tyler says it'll force them to be lean and efficient.
If we survive the recession, then we have a great concept because it can survive the worst. We're going to do great during the best.
They'll do that partly by following their own advice.
Just keep it simple. When you overcomplicate things, that's when you're probably going to fail.
Yeah, it's called KISS. Keep it simple, stupid.
El Gringo's restaurant opened on April 20th. Tyler says mostly business has been great. And for their first meals, Crystal decided on the Mexi plate with brisket. Tyler had the one new item on the menu, a Cubano sandwich made with a panini press that would have been way too big for their food truck. In Anchorage, I'm Hannah Floor.
Tambayan at Quintuhan features the stories, photos, and belongings of Filipino elders in Juneau. The exhibit is produced with Mana Alaska, a nonprofit dedicated to archiving Filipino-American history in the state. KTOO's Jamie Deep attended the exhibit's opening in Juneau and shares these voices.
I'm Vicky Lorenzo Villanueva, and I retired registered nurse at Bartlett Regional Hospital.
I am Dom Villanueva, and I'm retired in the Coast Guard and also the Postal Service. When I was stationed aboard ship, yeah, we played lots of music. Guitar, harmonica, and all that stuff.
It's really an honor, you know, and we're so blessed because among all the Filipino people here in Juneau, we were one of those who were interviewed. We are on the wall. We can't believe it. We're so happy to be a part of this.
My name is Delma Sianco, and I've been here in Juneau since 1996, and I'm married to Judge Rick Sianco. He was actually interviewed sometime in 2023, and they started this project in 2023. He was still alive then, but same year he passed on. With so many elders we have who already have passed on, and at least he was still around to say his story, and I wish they could interview more to hear other family stories as well. I'm glad that Mana had this idea so that for the younger generations that they still, you know, somehow be able to see pictures, read stories, hear stories of their parents, grandparents. And especially at this time when we have all these Gen Zs, they have different interests now. At least there is still that culture, that way of life that they can relate to by just watching this exhibit.
I'm Virginia Kelly, and I'm retired. I worked for the state for 35 years. And my mom was one of the elders. She passed away 2 years ago. Yeah. So, yeah, that was good that they interviewed her. There's a lot of things that I didn't know that she was telling them, you know, like during the war and stuff like that. So I was not aware of everything that's happened. My kids are born here, so they don't know my upbringing, the resilience of a lot of Filipinos, and my mom's legacy. That's kind of nice for them to know about that. We would like a lot of people, especially here in Juneau, to know about Filipinos. Because there's a lot, it's not about adobo or lumpia. You know, there's a lot about Filipinos. We work hard, you know, so, and we want to kind of like share our culture, not only the food. That's why I like to volunteer. I want to be part of it.
My name is Pearl Grace Paniloni, and I am the community engagement director at Mana. I hope that people are inspired to talk with other people and listen, and also not be afraid to share their own stories. As we were talking with these elders, there's a lot of them that were very timid, like, oh, my story doesn't matter. Like, why are you talking to little old me? But as we like dug deeper and we like saw the struggles, the trials and tribulations they've been through, and how they've just like built their foundation off of love and connection and strength, I hope that empowers people to feel that in themselves, and share their story and know that they matter.
That was an audio postcard from Tambayan Atquintuhan, now on exhibit in Juneau.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon, and welcome to your Island Messenger for Tuesday. It is the fifth day of May, the year 2026. The sun rose today at 6:07. It will set again at 10:06. That will give us 15 hours and 58 minutes of glorious daylight, a gain of 4 minutes and 31 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record high temperature for this date was 68 degrees, set in 2004, and our record low is 18, set in 1945. Our current temperature is 46 degrees under mostly cloudy skies. At the airport, they indicate they have steady west winds at 16 miles per hour, gusting to 23, and 10 miles of visibility. Mostly cloudy skies for the rest of the day today and overnight, too. They are expecting rain to begin about 4 p.m. and last until about 7 p.m. For tomorrow, look for mostly sunny skies, high near 48, west winds 5 or 10, turning to the south tomorrow afternoon. We have an incoming tide. Our next high tide here on the east side will happen at 5:35 this afternoon and be 6.1 feet, followed by a low tide at 10:34 p.m. of 3.2 feet. Over on the west side, your next high tide will happen at 5:46 p.m. and be 10.9 feet in Larsen Bay, followed by a low tide at 11:13 p.m. of 4.7 feet. The moon is 86.5%, and it is waning. Mariners, here is your weather forecast for Marmot Island, Sitkanak, out to 15 nautical miles. Small craft advisory today with west winds to 20 knots, becoming southwest 20 tonight. 13-foot seas today are expected to subside to 7 feet by tonight. For tomorrow on our east side, west 20 and seas at 6 feet. Over in the Shelikof Strait, west 15 today, becoming southwest 20 tonight. 3-foot seas today, building to 5 feet tonight in the Shelikof. For tomorrow, west 20 and seas to 5 feet. Just outside of the city of Kodiak in Chiniak Bay, look for variable less than 10 seas to 2 feet for today and tonight, turning to the west 10 after midnight. And for tomorrow, west 10 in the morning, becoming variable less than 10 and 2-foot seas remaining on our west side. There will be a vigil and wreath release for missing and murdered Indigenous people tonight, starting at 5 p.m. on Oscar's Spit in downtown Kodiak. There will also be resources on hand from Canada Tribal Victim Services, as well as the Kodiak Ruins Resource and Crisis Center. Again, that's tonight, the vigil and wreath release at Oscar Spit, 5 p.m. for missing and murdered Indigenous peoples. The Kodiak City Council will hold a budget work session tonight in the City Hall Conference Room. The meeting will begin at 5:30 p.m. and is open to the public. And there will be another budget work session on Thursday, also at 5:30 p.m. and also in the City Hall Conference Room, and also open to the public. The meetings will also be web streamed, and the web streaming links and meeting packets are available online at the City of Kodiak website. If you need more information, contact the city clerk at 907-486-8636. The Women's Bay Service Area Board will be having their regular meeting tonight in the Bayside Fire Hall at 5:30 p.m. On Thursday, the Kodiak Island Borough Assembly will be having their regular meeting in the Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. The meetings are open to the public, and the packets are available on the Kodiak Island Borough website. Contact the Borough Clerk's Office at 907-486-9310 with any questions.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 3 times a day. Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.
Welcome to KMXT's Talk of the Rock, our local community affairs program, where we explore issues and organizations related to our community. Talk of the Rock is hosted by members of the KMXT News team.
Talk of the Rock here on KMXT. I'm your host, Davis. Thanks so much for tuning in. I've got two guests in the studio today, and I'm going to let them introduce themselves in a moment. But just a heads up, we are talking about our local fire departments and local firefighters. We're going to talk a lot today about recruitment and all sorts of things for what it takes to be a firefighter on Kodiak Island. So with that, I'll let my guests introduce themselves, starting with you, please, Rich.
Hey, good afternoon. It's Rich Gonzalez. I'm the fire chief over at the Kodiak Fire Department.
Awesome. And Scott.
And Scott Ellis over at Bayside Kodiak Island Borough.
Awesome. Thank you both.